Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 92, recorded December 14th, 2011. Greetings, everyone. I'm afraid Kelly is not with us tonight. We've had to divide and conquer a bit with the holidays and all. It's a busy season, so you can look forward to Kelly next week. But for now, it's just me, flying solo. Well, this week we have some contributions from Juliet in Paris, France, Mick in Carnforth, UK, and Randall and Shirley in Utah. So we'll start out with Juliet's message. She had sent me some questions about her shrimp. She's having a shrimp crisis with her red cherry shrimp and was wondering what to do. I sent her some ideas, and she tried some of those out. First, she vacuumed the gravel, added a second filter with some carbon in it for a couple of days, and switched the diet to a specialized shrimp pellet, and hadn't had any losses for a while. She said when she was at the local fish store, they offered her a yellow apple snail, and she put that in the shrimp tank. She had already had a zebra nerite snail that was a very placid algae eater, and she expected it to be very similar, but it wasn't. It shaved the heads off her younger water plants, bulldozed its way through the substrate and right through the shrimp to steal their food, and generally made a mess in the tank. And he's now alone in a different tank, an endler tank. She was surprised by the difference in behavior and compatibility, and she took it as a lesson not to take these guys for granted and think of creatures like that as, you know, part of the decor, but always to read up on such things before acquiring new creatures. As she mentioned, and this is a quote, two minutes on the web told me this guy should not really be kept with a shrimp at all. Yeah, snails do definitely differ widely in their habits and food preferences and things like that. So there are some snails, a lot of snails called apple snails, and some of them are even worse than the one you probably had, because the yellow apple snails, also called mystery snails depending on where you are and so on, are smaller than the snails that I'm thinking of when I think of apple snails, which are very nearly the same size as an apple, and they will eat any plant. They're crazy. So, yeah, it's always good to do your research on such things. All right, she also mentioned that she got her first pair of cribs, or cribensis, a kind of cichlid from Africa, not from the Rift Lakes like some of the others. It's a very beautiful fish. We did do a podcast on these a while ago. She had never had them before and really likes them. She said their colors really flare up when they're being fed, and they inspect everything. They can also move very, very fast and will attack food items bigger than themselves. She had to move her Amano shrimp, even though the cribs are juveniles and the shrimp are almost bigger than they are. They're not attacking any fish except a few leftover endler fry that she's having trouble getting out of the tank because it's a heavily planted tank. She mentions that she'll have to watch some of the fish when these guys spawn and prepare for possible moves to other aquariums. And I like this. She says, gotta hand it to the cichlids when it comes to personality. Nothing much beats them. That's very true. And then back to the shrimp a little bit. She said she's hoping all that will be well. She was wondering if the main problem was just too much food waste in the substrate. No bubbles or anything, but possibly a rise at the bottom of the tank of some toxin. With regards to that, do you believe a sponge filter is enough to clean this tank, or should I just switch to the other one? The 15 to 20 liter tank with approximately 20 shrimp in it so far. The other filter is one of those small box thingies with quite a strong flow. Just has blue foam in it, but you can add a bit of carbon in a hole in the middle of the foam if you want to. It came with a nano tank I got. Okay, but then she sent us another email not too long after that, saying, spoke too soon, another buried female dead. There's something more going on here than just water conditions. I've lost no males and no young ones, and neither have I lost my old males from almost 2 years ago. It's only the buried females, and it's only when they're about due, and you can almost see the babies in the eggs. For me, that spells deficiency or parasites or some kind of weird egg disease. I have no idea, actually. There are some funny little white things zooming around that look like minute water fleas, but they are so small I cannot see what they look like. I'm gripping at straws here. Are there any shrimp experts out there listening? It's about the most frustrating thing I have ever been through. Help! Well, Juliet, that is a weird situation indeed. And so, shrimpers out there, with the new data that she's provided, if you have any ideas, I can say with some confidence that the funny little white things zooming around that look like minute water fleas are probably not causing the issue. I suspect they're seed shrimp. There are a lot of different types of seed shrimp that show up in aquaria. They're pretty much harmless, and they often show up in places where there are no fish to eat them, so I expect that's what you're seeing, but those probably not an issue. But as far as everything else goes, I'm not sure what to say. Something that I've done with shrimp as far as filtration goes, you asked about the sponge filter. When I have kept cherry shrimp on their own, I will sometimes use a hang-on-the-back power filter and then just put a sponge, kind of a coarse sponge, over the intake to prevent the babies from being sucked up, and that does really well because I think it moves more water and it gets more particulate matter out than a sponge filter does. But that's just one possibility. I know that Mick responded to your previous message from last week, and let's transition over to Mick and see what he has to say. It looks like Mick had some ideas about the shrimp issue that Juliet had been having. So he said that his first thought that was that the gravel was much deeper than he would use, and that he would suggest taking a vial of the tank water to a local reliable aquarium shop and see if they would do a series of tests for you. And then he'd give the gravel a good clean with an aquarium siphon cleaner, which Juliet has done, and then start taking some gravel out. And I really liked his suggestion for how to do that safely. He said a reptile vivarium scoop is good for this, as it lets the water drain out while being robust enough to lift the gravel. And you can probably find that in your local pet store. And he said, I would be very careful to do this in small quantities over several days, as digging up the whole substrate would probably do more harm than good. And I agree, that would be a much safer way to do it. So hopefully, Juliet, that is something that may help your shrimp out. And Mick continues, saying that they have had one of their high tides lately in his area, and he took some pictures of this, so please check them out on the resources page. They're virtually on the coastline, and there's an estuary running along the edge of the fields behind their street. So sometimes they see things like crabs crossing in the water, or shrimp, gobies, whole host of sea life that can get caught out in the flood holes by the road. They've had a lot of rainfall lately, about 4 inches of water in the rain gauge in the last week. And the winds around the coast were around 35 miles per hour and getting up to 75 miles per hour on the fells and dales. So that's some pretty crazy weather, and it leads to some interesting marine life visiting, perhaps more closely than they would otherwise do. So that sounds like an interesting experience. And once again, check out the pictures of that on the resources page. Now, in mixed tanks, his albino cribs spawned again, but Mick figures that he must have spooked them when he was cleaning the tank, as they had eaten the eggs when he went in yesterday to take some pics. So, yeah, not uncommon thing for cichlids to do, especially early on in their pair bond when they're spawning for the first few times. As I recall, my cribs did something similar. The first couple of clutches of eggs they didn't succeed with. I think it was the third clutch that they finally begin to succeed with, so makes sense. And Mick closes with these words. I just had to repeat them because I thought they were fun. Hope you guys have a very fishy Christmas and a shrimpy New Year. I like that. Thanks, Mick. And now we will move on to Randall and Shirley's questions. Randall and Shirley in Utah. Now, I'd like to approach this in two sections, because first I'd like to mention some things that I wish I had known as a beginning aquarist. And I know Randall and Shirley have had an aquarium for some time, but they're kind of transitioning from a smaller aquarium to a bigger one, and so I think a lot of these things could be relevant. And then I will move on to the other question, which is how to restock a tank after it has crashed. And, you know, bearing in mind that diseases and such things might be an issue, and not wanting to repeat the same issue that caused those, how can you restock a tank? So first, 11 things I wish I had known as a beginning aquarist, and then a list of 5 things that you can do when restocking a tank. So for the first thing, and these are in no particular order, I'm not doing this by order of importance, it's just how I happen to write them down. Number 1. Quarantine. Now, quarantine is probably overlooked in a lot of situations, and this is partly because it's not always necessary. It is sometimes possible to introduce fish from a variety of aquaria and have them do well and not show any signs of disease and whatnot. So it sometimes works, but it is always a risk to add fish from another aquarium to your own without quarantining first. So I would suggest setting up a small quarantine tank somewhere. It doesn't have to be really fancy. In fact, it's many times better if it doesn't have gravel in it, for example. It just has a filter and some places for the fish to hide, maybe a few plastic plants, because medications can often kill live plants. So a couple of plastic plants as cover, maybe a flower pot turned on its side for the fish to hide in, something like that. And then a filter. And many times one of the best ways to keep the filter nice and cycled is to simply keep a filter pad or keep maybe a sponge filter in a corner of a larger tank somewhere of your main tank, and then when you're ready to use the quarantine tank, you just take that sponge filter out and put it in your quarantine tank, and that can function as the filter. And then when you're done, you can sterilize it and then put it back in your tank, and then you're good to go again, and because after a few weeks in your tank, it will again develop the beneficial bacteria. But I would recommend keeping new acquisitions in the quarantine tank for at least 2 weeks. I think that's the general recommendation, minimum recommendation. It's usually better to do it longer. If you could do it for a month, that's great. And if anything shows up, you can treat it in that tank without worrying about the gravel, without worrying about disturbing any beneficial bacteria beds there in the gravel, things like that, or discoloring the gravel, which can happen with certain medications. And then if you don't need to treat them, then fine, you can set them, you can put them in the other tank once the time period has passed. So quarantining always helps minimize the risk of introducing new specimens to your tank. Number two, I call this one avoiding the Noah's Ark syndrome. A lot of beginning aquarists especially will walk into a pet store and just be dazzled by the appearance of all these beautiful fish and say, oh, I like those. Can I have a couple of those? And I'll take two of those, too. And how about a couple of these? That would be great. And pretty soon you have a hodgepodge that's just, you know, not ideal in terms of the kinds of interactions you'll get in the tank. Maybe compatibility is not the best, but a whole bunch of fish from different species will not tend to move harmoniously in a tank, and so they're just not as attractive. And so that can be an issue too. So instead of succumbing to this syndrome, one good thing to do is before you even put any fish in the tank, before you even go to the pet store to buy fish, think about what you want from your tank. Do you want to showcase one species? A species tank can be quite striking. If you've ever seen a tank full of 50 neon tetras, for example, and that's the only fish in the tank, this is this one species, but it can be quite amazing. So if you want to showcase a particular species, that's one way to go. Would you rather observe really complex behavior, such as parental care? You know, if you want to get a pair of cichlids and watch them indulge in parental care, or you want to watch the territoriality of some mbunas from Lake Malawi, different things like that. It's good to think about whether behavior of the fish and in complex different types of behavior is important to you. Or maybe you like interaction in terms of personality, in terms of how the fish interacts with you. Some fish are much more interactive with humans than others, and that can be a draw for some aquarists. Or maybe you just want variety. You want to see a lot of different things going on in the tank, a lot of different sizes, shapes, colors, whatever. And if that's the case, it might be better to think in terms of, you know, sometimes the classic model of think about which fish swim in the midwater, which swim at the surface, and which swim at the bottom. But then don't add so many different species of each type. Maybe one of each species would be better than three or four of each. You might get a more cohesive feel to it, but still a lot of variety. So think about that before you go to the pet store to get a fish. I really wish I would have known that when I first started out. Number three, is think bigger than 10 gallons, if at all possible. And with that, we will take our break.
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
Okay, and we're back. The ideas of thinking bigger than 10 gallons if possible. There are a lot of things you can do with a 10-gallon tank, but there are not nearly as many things you can do with a 10-gallon tank as many of us would like to believe. There just isn't a lot of room in a 10-gallon tank, and you have to go with either fairly small fish or a fairly sedentary fish, and you can't really make a community tank with as many species as you might think you could. So that's one reason why you should try to go for a bigger tank if you can. But another reason is that bigger tanks are just more forgiving in terms of environmental issues. And I don't mean things like global warming. What I mean is if you have a toxin or pollutant in the tank, that in 30 gallons, that given amount of toxin is less likely to be as much of a problem as it is in a 10-gallon tank. Not gallon per gallon, but just in an absolute sense. So they're just a little more forgiving that way. Temperature is another one. Temperature is more likely to fluctuate quickly in a 10-gallon tank than it is in a 55. Fact of life. So there you go. If you have a power loss like we were speaking a week or two ago, it's going to be a lot easier to maintain the temperature in a bigger tank than in a smaller one. Now, number four. Frequent partial water changes. I'm going to say that again. Frequent. Partial. Water changes. Okay. They solve a lot of problems before they start, frankly. And what do I mean by frequent? Well, I would say once a week. Twice a week would be better. Of course, every day would be better, but most of us don't have that kind of time. So if you can do it once a week, that's really doing pretty well. How much to change? Well, at least 20%, 40 would be better. Somewhere between there is what I usually do on most of my tanks, somewhere between 20 and 40 once a week. And that seems to work pretty well, although I notice when I'm able to do more changes, it's better. And we'll talk a little bit more about some ways to make that easier. But they really do solve a lot of problems before they start. The water changes help reduce things like nitrates, which you want to reduce. They also energize the fish. They tend to enjoy the water changes. They replenish trace elements and things like that. And they also reduce things beyond nitrates, dissolved organics and things like that. So very, very important. Number five, cycling the tank. Now, that's really important, but if you can manage to do it fishlessly, so much the better. If you're still not sure on cycling, what cycling a tank is, do a search for cycling aquarium or nitrogen cycle aquarium, something like that. Read up on it. Make sure you understand how that works. It's extremely important. And fishless cycle. If you do a search for fishless cycle, that's even better, because basically, if you cycle with fish, you're stressing the fish a lot. If you cycle without the fish, there are no fish to be stressed. So it seems just kind of logical. Why not do that? Why not cycle it fishlessly? It's not any more difficult, except for one thing. In terms of patience, it's more difficult because it's hard to stare at a tank that seems ready, that looks ready to have fish in it, but doesn't yet. But it will be well worth the wait if you cycle fishlessly. Number six, do your research on species and compatibility and etc. before purchase. It's tempting to just see a beautiful fish and say, hey, that's the one I want, but it is not so fun when you bring that fish home and find out that it rips up your other fish, or you find out that the water conditions it requires really don't match those of your other fish. Or you find out that it's perfectly happy in your tank for the time being, but within a year it's going to be 6 inches longer and going to swallow everything in sight. Things like that. It's very important to look those things up. Many aquarists buy a fish even knowing that it's going to get too large, and then they find out later that they couldn't buy the big tank that they were planning on buying before. So that's not even a good idea. Research what you're going to buy and then make sure that you can actually take care of it. Number 7. The big 3 in terms of hard-to-kill aquarium plants. Java fern, Java moss, and Anubias nana. These are extremely valuable in terms of easily kept plants that will grow in most aquaria. Of course, you can't keep them with highly herbivorous fish, but these three are resistant to a lot of fish that would eat other plants. They are very forgiving in terms of water conditions. They're not very demanding in terms of light requirements. They're great places for fish to hang out. They do increase the water quality by absorbing certain wastes of the fish, notably nitrate and others, that help make the water quality better, but they provide food for the fish in terms of, well, especially the Java moss. Microorganisms will grow on the moss itself, and so baby fish particularly can use them as a grazing area where they get food. So there's so many reasons that these are great plants to grow, and they are the easiest ones to grow. So once again, you should do your research before getting any, but they're very likely, if you're keeping a tank, that at least one of these can fit in your tank and do well. And more likely, more than one of them could. And they help your tank in so many ways, and they're attractive too. Number 8. Seek out local or online aquarists who can serve as mentors. There's nothing like having someone who is experienced to help you along. It is important to be a bit discriminating, particularly online, because it is easy for someone to pose as an expert but not be one. And it's important to realize that that can happen easily, and that you should avoid that. But at the same time, there are so many people out there with a lot of knowledge who are willing to help. They're very free with their willingness to help, and that is a beautiful thing that can lead to a good relationship with those people and a good experience in aquarium keeping. So I do recommend that. Number 9. Seek out a good specialized aquarium store. Now, big box stores have their place, I suppose, but there are so many advantages to having a specialized aquarium store. One is that you're more likely to get more interesting fish because the big box stores tend to stock the heavy sellers, but not necessarily so much the rarer and maybe more fascinating in many cases fish that you might not be exposed to in a big box store. Another one is that such a store is more likely to take things for credit. So if you're breeding a particular species and bring it to a big box store, they likely will not accept it. But a local aquarium store, if you make arrangements with them beforehand, they're usually happy to get things like that as long as it's not a species that's consistently overstocked. Something that everybody tries to bring in. So that's a good thing too. And they seem, in general, because they're a specialized aquarium store, they already have a leg up in terms of experience and knowledge and interest in fish specifically. So there are other reasons, too, why a good specialized aquarium store is a good place to go, but those are a few to give you a start. Number 10, get some sort of system for changing water more easily. This is so important because it will help you to do it more often. If you have if you're in a hurry, it's crunch time, you need to get it done. If you have something that makes it easier, you're more likely to get it done. Of course, it's a lot easier on your back than lugging a bucket around, too. So I use the Python No Spill Clean and Fill. I understand that that brand is a little hard to get a hold of now, but I know that Aquion and Lee's both produce a similar water-changing device that allows you to wash the gravel as well as change the water and refill the tank with the same hose that's hooked up to the sink. So look into that. I remember when I got 55-gallon tank for the first time years ago. That's when I finally broke down and got one because it just wasn't working with the bucket anymore. My back was getting tired of lugging things. And I never looked back. In fact, in Hawaii, I remember building one. I built a water changer just by using component parts of various things that I put together, some from a garden part of the store, some from a pet store, some from, you know, a hardware store and different things, putting different things together. It's not too difficult to do. It's a simple, the hardware is fairly simple to get, and it's easy to put together conceptually, but just having one is the most important thing. So if you want to make your own, you can look online for do-it-yourself aquarium water changer. There are various plans there and so on. Or you can just go buy one, make it a little easier. But either way, it will make your life, in terms of your aquarium, a lot easier. And you're a lot more likely to do, like I said, the water changes. Now, number 11. Just perform regular checks on things, like your filter, your heater, your thermometer. It's really easy and quick to do a check of your heater and your thermometer because it's kind of doing the same thing by glancing at your thermometer. You can check if they're both in good working order. But in terms of the filter, it's a little more complicated, but not so much. It's important to replace or rinse the filter media when needed. And it's also very important to clean out the tubes and impellers. You can get a set of foxtail brushes from the pet store, so you can do that. And it's really easy, if you don't do this often, for the filters to kind of get a little bit neglected. As long as there's some water running there, you don't realize how fast they used to flow and how slowly they're flowing now because it's so gradual. But a lot of times things can build up, organic matter will build up inside the tubes, and then after a while it can lead to a sharp decline in water quality without you really noticing what's going on unless you keep on top of that. So make sure that the flow is not impeded by cleaning out the insides of the tubes and so on. Make sure the impeller is not encased in goo. You can get a toothbrush that you never have had toothbrush on because, you know, toothpaste is not good for fish. And of course, you'd never want to put that toothbrush in your mouth, but I didn't even need to say that, but I did anyway. Anyway, you could use a toothbrush that's designated specifically for cleaning impellers and just lightly scrub that, being careful not to bend it. The impeller is the little propeller-looking thing in there, inside the filter. And keeping those things clean can go a long way towards making sure your filter is operating efficiently. Now, those were 11 items. I say if I had to cut them down to 4, this is what I would tell you. Number 1, fishlessly cycle your tank before you put any fish in it. 2, don't skimp on regular partial water changes. 3, make sure your filter is operating efficiently. And 4, take a minute or two every day to check your temperatures and just make general observations while you observe and feed your fish. 90% of the problems with every aquarium in the world would be reduced drastically if everyone were to do just those things. Okay, so now to address Randall and Shirley's most recent question about restocking a tank after a crash. One of the things they wanted to know is how long to wait before restocking, and another one is how do we start introducing the fish? Do we do it gradually? Do we put in one fish, wait for a while, see how it does? You know, what should we do? So I put together 5 steps to help with this. Now, the first step is to quarantine the tank, so to speak, if you've had a disease issue. If there have been any sort of disease or something you might suspect it's a disease, you should behave as if the fish contained, or as if the tank contained fish being quarantined. So at least 2 weeks, a month would be better, where you don't add any fish, and then any opportunistic pathogens of any sort are not likely to be left over in any numbers that can threaten the fish, as long as you've been doing your partial water changes so that the water quality is good in the tank and you put them in. It should be fine. Number 2, I just alluded to this a little bit, keep doing the weekly partial water changes while you are waiting, 20 to 40% per week. If you're doing that, you can help keep the water quality good while you're waiting for the other fish to come, and because the water quality, maybe not as quickly as it would if there were fish in there without being changed, but the water quality will decline if water changes are not done. Number 3 is keep the cycle going. the beneficial bacteria that were living on the waste produced by your fish will not do so well if they don't get regular food. They do need to eat, and they need to they need ammonia. And a way to get that, the easiest way probably, is just to add a pinch of fish food every day or so. Not too much, because you're not actually feeding fish, just bacteria, of course. But just a small pinch of food in the tank every other day or so to keep the cycle going. Otherwise, you'll have to start the whole thing over, and you don't want to do that with the fish in there. So this is a chance, basically, for you to fishless cycle your tank while you're waiting, or at least keep it in a cycled state fishlessly. Then the next item, before you put any fish in, test for ammonia, nitrites, and nitrates. You should get a reading of 0 for ammonia, a reading of 0 for nitrites, and then you should get a moderate reading of nitrates. It might be, for example, 40 parts per million, something like that. You don't want it to be ridiculously high. If it's 120, that's not good. But you want some nitrate reading to indicate bacteria are doing what they're supposed to be doing, and changing ammonia to nitrite, and then in turn to nitrate. If you are getting any ammonia or nitrite readings, just keep fishless cycling until you don't get them anymore, and you get a nitrate reading. Otherwise, you're just asking for trouble, basically, so that's a good way to make sure it's okay. There are some indications that a tank has cycled that, you know, don't involve a test kit, but I would at least get just some of the test strips that you can plop in there, and they'll read several of these things at once, and then you don't have to worry about all the reagents and everything, and it's a little bit less complicated, maybe not as accurate, but maybe enough for the purpose. All right, now number 5 is put in your first few fish. I would highly recommend that you get all of the fish you put in from the same tank, so that you're not introducing fish from all these different tanks, because you could be introducing diseases and sort of defeating the purpose of quarantining, for example. Now, if you can manage to do so, it would be nice to take these first few fish, put them in the quarantine tank, leave them in there for a couple of weeks to see if they develop any diseases, which you can then treat in the quarantine tank rather than the main tank, so that you don't have to worry about damaging the beneficial bacteria and so on, or staining plants or different things like that with medications. Treat them in the quarantine tank if necessary, but if you start them out there and then move them to the main tank, and they do well for a few weeks without any signs of disease, then you can start adding other species, but I would also do that somewhat gradually. So maybe after 3 weeks, if everything looks good, you can quarantine some other species and add those, and so on, until you've reached the recommended stocking level, or preferably stay under the recommended stocking level for your tank. Even apparently healthy fish put into a tank can easily introduce parasites or other pathogens. It's always a risk. A fish can look healthy, but there can be parasites or pathogens in the water that you add the fish with, or the fish can actually be already infected with something, but it just hasn't reached the point where it's visible yet. So it may seem like a pain, and it's not always 100% necessary, but it's always a great way to avoid problems just by quarantining. So hopefully that's given you some ideas to go on. I'd like to thank once again Juliet in Paris, France, Mick in Carnforth, UK, and Randall and Shirley in Utah for their contributions. And as always,
may the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.